Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. All the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. This week, the Mid-Valley's Crown Mountain Park received voter support, and the city of Aspen could be nearing resolution on a water rights case involving Castle and Maroon Creeks.
Also, we look back at the 2018 Colorado legislative session, and we speak with several local artists who are working together on paintings and sculptures.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition.
On Tuesday, voters passed a property tax increase to support Crown Mountain Park in Elgibel. Allison Bektash reports.
2,300 ballots were cast from across the Crown Mountain Park and Recreation District, which stretches from Elgibel to Old Snowmass and goes as far east as Rudi Reservoir. Unofficial results show the measure passing by a mere 72 votes. It's estimated the measure will bring in an additional $700,000 each year for the park. Staff says the funds will go to replacing aging infrastructure like the irrigation system. Homeowners in the district will now pay an additional $14 for every $100,000 of their home's value. Commercial property owners will see a tax hike of $57 more per year for every $100 of property value that they own. Allison Bektash, Aspen Public Radio News.
The stage of the Wheeler Opera House is dark for the month of May for upgrades.
The biggest project taking place at the Wheeler this month is a complete replacement of the orchestra seating. Jenna Bueller, the executive director of the Wheeler, says that the standard theater seat lasts between 10 to 12 years. The chairs were last replaced in 2006, so they are past due for an upgrade. Other upgrades include painting and wall repairs. Bueller says that the repairs are part of the Wheeler's long-term capital improvement plan. She says that because the building is operational most of the year, some annual downtime must be planned to keep the building in top form. The Wheeler reopens the first week of June with the production Newtopia, a dance and acrobatic performance celebrating the musical messages of the Beatles. Kristen Kay, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
Colorado's 2018 legislative session began under a cloud of sexual harassment allegations, and it's ending the same way. And even after one lawmaker was expelled from office, there are some who feel Colorado's top leaders are not doing enough to make the Capitol a safer and more professional workplace. Benta Berkland has more.
After a dramatic and tearful day in early March, Colorado lawmakers voted out one of their own. Democratic Representative Steve Lebsack was the first lawmaker expelled in 103 years after allegations of sexual harassment, intimidation, and retaliation from five women were found to be credible.
I walked in that morning thinking nothing was going to happen, and I left with an ounce of justice.
Former legislative aide Cassie Tanner was one of the complainants. She alleged that Lebsack unbuttoned the top part of her blouse at a legislative function and said, quote, "That's better."
It was a gratifying result to know that I had not only been believed, but that the House of Representatives was going to take my complaint and the complaints of Representative Lebsack's other accusers seriously.
And in the 2 months since then?
After Lebsack, it really felt like the air came out of the balloon and people felt like that was the end.
Our reporting, though, has found that wasn't the end. Our stories led to workplace harassment allegations from 11 additional people against three Republican senators. Each allegation has been found to be credible by outside investigators. But all of those senators are still serving in office, and none have admitted wrongdoing.
I think what's really upsetting is that despite numerous credible findings of sexual harassment, there's really been, other than Lebsack, no meaningful accountability.
Bree Franklin heads the Colorado Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Republican Senator Randy Baumgardner has faced the most allegations, including that he grabbed and slapped a former legislative aide's behind and created a hostile and offensive work environment for some staff. Baumgardner survived an expulsion vote in April. In Colorado, legislative leaders determine consequences. Republican Senate President Kevin Grantham voted against expulsion, but did punish Baumgardner. He recently stripped him of serving on committees that meet over the summer.
People are going to criticize no matter what I decided to do on that. People that say it's not far enough, I think are acutely unaware of just how important those committees are.
It means you believed allegations, otherwise you wouldn't remove them.
That's Joan Fitzgerald. She's a Democrat and served as Colorado's first female Senate president. She says removing Baumgartner from summer committees amounts to virtually no punishment and called his behavior beyond boorish.
Unwarranted sexual advances to women, touching their breasts, slapping them on the buttocks, making lewd comments, insisting that women drink with him in the office, none of which is acceptable.
Senate Democrats have renewed their calls for Baumgartner to resign or be expelled. Still, Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper, who was weighing a presidential run, told us that he's more focused on solving other issues like long-term infrastructure spending and didn't want to tell lawmakers how to handle the situation.
What is the offense that requires someone where they should give up their seat, right? So it's a gray area, so it really is just a matter of opinion. My opinion is not that much more relevant than somebody else's. The one difference is my opinion might deeply upset or unsettle people that are trying to find compromises on things that are, you know, of deep significance.
Hickenlooper later gave us a statement saying he wants people to feel safe and supported and says Baumgartner's punishment is too little too late. Franklin, with the Colorado Coalition Against Sexual Assault, says the governor's lack of leadership on Baumgartner has been disheartening.
Why is this issue not as important as other issues? As the leader for the state, it would definitely be nice if he spoke up and called on them to hold themselves accountable.
A survey of the Capitol showed a third of people have experienced sexual harassment, but nearly 90% chose not to report it. Lawmakers have hired an HR person. They originally pledged to improve the workplace harassment policy this session, but are now studying the issue over the summer. Cassie Tanner says she thinks some lawmakers and the governor see the issue of sexual harassment and the allegations and investigations as distractions.
I think that's one of the reasons we've seen so much not being done is because they're like, we need to move past this and get to the real work. Without a recognition that real work can't happen in an environment where women feel unsafe.
She says all you have to do is look at the reports to see the behavior is unacceptable. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Kristen Kay. And Elizabeth, obviously, if people are listening to Mountain Edition, they want to stay informed about local news.
Absolutely. One of the ways they can do this is by visiting Aspen Public Radio's Facebook page. While you're there, don't hesitate to like it.
There you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook. For many, spring is a time for cleaning. That's also true on farms in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico, where farmers spend their weekends banding together to clean out irrigation ditches. This method of managing water is unique in the West, and as Luke Runyon reports, there's a struggle to pass on these traditions to the next generation.
A warm spring has already melted much of the snow in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains in southern Colorado, and water is already flowing through this ditch near the rural village of San Pablo. Every now and then, Dan Quintana, in weathered work gloves and a ball cap, raises up his shovel and slams it into the mud and matted willows that line the waterway. His slight frame makes it easy for him to jump across the narrow ditch. It's 9 o'clock on a recent windy Saturday morning.
So it's flood irrigated, all these get flood irrigated, and that's how everybody irrigates their properties.
It's all part of the limpieza, or ditch cleaning. If you irrigate, Quintana says you or one of your family members is expected to be here, shoveling out muck, removing trash and tree limbs. It's an annual obligation.
And making sure there's no obstructions in the ditch that prevent the water flow for the users downstream.
Small farm towns like San Pablo are organized around acequias, networks of ditches and canals dug more than a century ago. It's what makes farming possible in the dry San Luis Valley. While most Western law views water as property, something sold to the highest bidder, Esequias see it as a community asset.
It's kind of like informal, just community cooperation. Everybody knows they have right to it, and we just share, you know.
It's hard to overstate how radical the idea of sharing water in the West is. It's easy when water is plentiful. But in times of scarcity, everyone within an acequia feels the shortage together. Soon, lunchtime rolls around, and a group of middle-aged farmers leave their ditch-cleaning duties and pile into the back of an old pickup truck. We're heading to the volunteer fire station for chicken fajitas. Acequias vary in their style of governance, but a more common form is as a civic association with a board and at least one employee who runs the ditch. That person is the mayordomo.
I'm sure I'll be hearing from you, Andy.
Agustin Roy Esquibel is the mayordomo for the ditch that was cleaned today. After we arrive, he takes the time to shake everyone's hand and jokes that he'll have to walk a lot more ditches to work off these fajitas. Down the street is the Church of San Isidro, the Catholic saint of farmers. The land here is mostly used to grow hay or other grasses for cattle and horses. As a water steward, Esquibel says his faith guides the decisions he makes.
It's being neighborly and, you know, treat people the way you'd want to be treated. We've lost a lot of that. That's just gone by the wayside. It's all about me, 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 what's in it for me. And I think over here, we still care about each other, care about the community.
While the water management here is unique, these towns also experience many of the same challenges as other rural areas across the country, like poverty, consolidating farms, and limited educational opportunities, all of which are causing young people to leave.
We all want the best for our kids, so we want to educate them and send them out, make some money. But they never came back, and it's heartbreaking.
After lunch, a group of teenagers gather around a fire pit in Juanita Martinez's backyard in the community of San Francisco. It's about a 10-minute drive from the fire station.
We're actually sitting right next to a babbling stream, and it's our acequia. And that's why you hear that nice, rhythmic, beautiful water sound.
Martinez is quick to crack a smile and is a leader in the community. She's also active in an acequia association in the valley.
It makes you think about who you are as a person, your values. Are you a good neighbor? Do you trust people? Do you value people?
More and more of the farmland has been purchased by absentee owners, she says. And that means it's hard to fill board positions within the acequia. And those landowners often don't participate in the limpieza, the ditch cleaning.
Oh God, it kills me. And the reason why is because what then? What kind of people do we become? What kind of values do we have?
As a community activist, as an educator, I'm extremely concerned about the next generation not being able to carry these traditions.
That's Shirley Romero Otero. She leads a youth group called Move Mountains. What concerns her the most is passing along the acequia way of life.
The key to this is to teach the kids about this is who you are. This is the community that formed you. This is your culture. This is the way you think, feel, and act.
There are only 8 young people living in the village of San Francisco. And like many small town kids, they're often counting the days until they can go off to college or find a job. That's why Otero makes sure they know why sharing water is unique, even if they leave.
If we can instill that in the hearts and the minds of young people, they will always come back and give to their community. I've seen it over and over again.
Sitting by the ditch in a camouflage jacket and sporting a buzz cut, 14-year-old Leon Medina digs through a box of arrowheads he's found in the nearby mountains.
My hobbies is looking for horns and finding arrowheads, and these are nice. That's a spearhead that my cousin had found.
Medina is in the youth group run by Shirley Romero Otero. He and his friends got together to help with today's limpieza.
You can see the rings around the trees where the water has been high, but now it's gone low. So you can tell it's going to be a drought.
Which is why the ditch cleaning takes on a different kind of urgency for Medina. Every drop of water will be even more valuable to the farmers, he says, like his dad.
He's had me irrigating his field since I was like 7 years old. So a lot of people, like all these old timers, ask me if I could always help them.
Medina is a ray of hope to the community. He wants to live here. He has an interest in how the acequias work, how to irrigate land, and how to build a community.
There's way more stuff to do out here, and just it's free out here. I mean, it's, I can't explain it. I mean, it's...
As his voice trails off, he gestures up toward the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and then back down toward the acequia and the water flowing at our feet. And while he does spend time outside the valley, he says he's always happy to come home. I'm Luke Runyon.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River, produced in partnership with public media station KUNC in Northern Colorado, with financial support by the Walton Family Foundation.
So, Elizabeth, as the environment reporter, you cover the world of water, and there's a lot happening right now.
There is a lot going on this spring, and it's no surprise that a lot of this started early this year.
We'll hear a story of yours coming up. This January, Aaron Million filed a claim for water on the Green River, with plans to divert it to Colorado's Front Range. The proposal and the many objections filed in response to it have raised questions about just how much water is available from the Colorado River and its tributaries.
Million is a graduate student at Colorado State University. His proposal with the Utah Division of Water Rights would pipe water 500 miles from the Green River in Utah to the Front Range. The diversion would be 55,000 acre feet, about half the capacity of Rudi Reservoir. Million says it's a simple project that brings water where there is demand for it.
It's a plumbing project. We're just looking at a small piece of the surpluses to bring new water supplies over.
But others say it isn't so simple. It's not clear that there actually is extra water. More than 30 protests have been filed with the Utah Division of Water Rights. Many of these come from organizations that think Million's team is skirting some major issues.
What you're doing is putting everybody at great risk.
Andy Mueller is executive director of the Colorado River District, which is tasked with safeguarding Colorado's water supply, which comes largely from the Colorado River Basin. That's a big, complex system that feeds 40 million people across 7 states and part of Mexico. The Green River is part of that. It connects to the Colorado in Utah. So when you pull water from the Green, it affects a delicate balance that has been in the works for nearly a century. Here's some history. In 1922, 7 states signed the Colorado River Compact, a legally binding agreement. The 4 upper basin states, that is, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico, agreed to let a set amount of water flow downriver into the lower basin, Arizona, Nevada, and California. But it's really dry in these states. You know, the arid west. And climate change means there's even less water in the river. So when new players like Million try to jump in the game, it adds some real tension. In the worst case scenario, a serious long-term drought, the lower basin states can cash in on that compact. This is the dreaded compact call. As Zane Kessler with the River District explains, we've never been through that before, but he thinks a proposal this big would push us closer to the edge.
We don't know what happens on the other side of that cliff because we've never been through it. We do know that it could cause chaos on a number of different levels, and that's, I think, the biggest concern for a lot of us.
But Million isn't too concerned about a compact call. He says basically it's an empty threat and points blame for any shortages at the lower basin states, saying they use more than their share. Plus, he says, this water is needed right here in Colorado.
We shouldn't let the water go to the lower basin while we're faced with the impacts we are on the upper basin.
The River District thinks he's oversimplifying because it's actually not totally clear how much water Colorado has left to claim. Mueller explains that recent studies have shown the state is probably already using its full share.
We think that we are at a point where we no longer have water to develop in the state of Colorado, in the Colorado River system.
So Mueller says the key to managing water in this complex system is working together. It's what has worked so far.
The entire river system is short of water, and we're all watching this very careful balance. That's the biggest concern, I think, that he's going around that developed consensus in our state.
That consensus surrounds all kinds of water users, everything from how to conserve water in cities to how to protect fish. Bart Miller is with Western Resource Advocates, which opposes Million's project on environmental grounds.
The Green River is really a stronghold, has been a stronghold for some of these endangered fish. And so it's a place that I think a lot of folks are concerned about the impacts of a large quantity of water being taken out.
Plus, Miller says it's not clear how exactly the diverted water will be used, and that breaks the anti-speculation rules in water law. Million has said the water would be used for hydropower, irrigating agricultural lands, and for municipal uses, like drinking water. But he hasn't said specifically who would use it in those ways.
I can't disclose that information currently.
Miller says that's a clear problem.
There aren't any identified users of the water. And in both Utah and Colorado, speculation for developing water just so you can have it is highly discouraged.
And that could set the foundation of a legal fight. For now, it's up to the Utah Division of Water Rights to decide if the project moves forward. This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other Aspen Public Radio news, the Garfield County Commissioners considered giving the Roaring Fork School District nearly $40,000 to design a safer way to walk and bike to Riverview School.
Tuesday was the election for Aspen's Fire Protection District Board of Directors.
Stream flows in the Roaring Fork watershed are slowly creeping upward, but the effects of this winter's low snowpack are already showing.
And our Spotlight Health series returns. This week, host Allison Bechtesh speaks to Spotlight Health co-directors Peggy Clark and Ruth Katz to hear about some of the biggest moments over the first 5 years of the conference and get a sneak peek into the 2018 Spotlight Health Conference.
All that and more are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
The Republicans' top priority bill of the session is now headed to the governor. The measure involved intense negotiations between both parties. Again, Benta Berkland.
Senate Bill 1 adds nearly $500 million for transportation in the next budget and then would commit $50 million per year for 20 years. It also involves a potential bonding question for voters to decide in 2019. Republican Senate President Kevin Grantham praised the effort when the bill unanimously passed the Senate.
This is a win, and not for us, folks. This is a win for our constituents. This is a win for Colorado.
Democrats negotiated for more money for transit projects, but the biggest sticking point was how much money the state would commit to bonds. House Republicans were the only caucus to oppose the final bill. They wanted a bonding question to go before voters this fall. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
The Roaring Fork Valley is an artist's mecca. Kristen spent some time with area artists who say that the community here is unusually close. Because of that support, the Valley just might have a signature aesthetic, collaborative art.
So I'll start from this side. I'm going to try and space them out like with a hairline.
Okay.
And then what I'll do is I'll see if we can see as we go.
David Kadama and Liz Heller are slowly fitting together dozens of geometric wooden and ceramic tiles.
Okay, so let's take a look and see if there's anything that...
It's hard to get... You know, purposeful randomness.
Mm-hmm.
It's like putting together a puzzle, except you can't look at the picture on the front of the box to solve an argument about which piece belongs where. When two artists want to create one piece of art, they first have to create the same vision, and that might mean some compromise. But there were no tense moments when Kadama and Heller first sat down to talk about working together.
We both came to the table with our own ideas, and we both said yes to the other person's idea and agreed to realize the other person's vision as, you know, as well as our own.
Saying yes to something that one person never would have imagined on their own is part of the power of collaborative art.
That's always the fun part of collaborating with someone, especially someone who works in a different medium.
For this pair, their support of each other grew even stronger through the inevitable ups and downs of the creative process. Kadama remembers making one wrong move and breaking one of Heller's tiles.
But it was like the bottom inside corner of the wedge, so I can't see it. But it was like pink,
yeah.
Nothing, broken. I'm like,
so I chip stuff all the time. And it's so frustrating.
That reaction certainly doesn't fit the stereotype of an angsty artist who might be too isolated or egotistical to work with anyone else.
As far as being a loner and being hard to deal with or temperamental or competitive, or I think this valley in particular has an amazing artistic community. And I think everybody is really supportive of one another.
Those partnerships take a wide range of forms. Some, like Kadama's and Heller's, or Aspen Santa Fe Ballet performing alongside pianist Joyce Yang, involve different mediums. Others create individual works that are meant to be shown alongside each other. And some hand over all control to the process. Stanley Bell and Takeo Hiramitsu are both painters. Their collaborative show, Word is Bond, was on display at the R2 Gallery last month. At the show's opening, attendees celebrate, sipping wine and admiring the bold, colorful canvases on the gallery walls. It's a chance for Bell and Hiramitsu to reflect on working together.
Yeah, I call it type 2 fun. It's like what I enjoy. You know, like, wow, that hike was 180 miles. I'd, like, in the middle of it, like, so miserable. And at the end, you're like, that was fantastic. We saw so many things and
Let's
did so many
again.
Things. Yeah.
They agree that the Roaring Fork Valley sees an unusual number of collaborations. Bell thinks that this is partially because there are just so many artists.
There's constantly access to people that you can ask, what do you think about this? Or you have those conversations.
For this show, one of them would start making marks on a canvas, and then they would turn the piece completely over to the other. Hiramitsu says that this collaboration was sometimes uncomfortable, but that stepping out of his comfort zone was important.
You would find me opting to like be more solo often, but it is like at a certain point, if I'm the only one who's referring to myself with my own work, with myself, it kind of like that self-referential loop, it just will become stagnant.
The glamour of the opening for Word is Bond is a far cry from the drafty workshop where Heller and Kadama are painstakingly arranging those wooden and ceramic tiles. But for now, these two artists are just happy to be on the journey together.
It's been an amazing experience.
Yeah.
From beginning to end. And we're not really at the end yet, but...
No, I think we're still at the beginning.
That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in for Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. Elizabeth, this week, you're hosting. You're going to dive into the local headlines with a panel of reporters and editors. Can you give us a little sneak preview?
We've had a lot going on this week, everything from housing to water issues to recreation changes in the valley. So that will be some of the topics we focus on.
Sounds great. Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.